This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, what 9/11 taught us about trauma and resilience. Then, people often hold back simple compliments because they worry it'll be awkward or meaningless. But what you say matters more than you think. And how much vitamin C do you really need? The definitive study on it was done more than 70 years ago. Now it's getting a fresh look. It's coming up on Top of Mind. Good to have you with us. As we've spent the last several days reflecting on the legacy of the 9/11 terror attacks, psychologist George Bonanno's perspective caught our eye. He studies how trauma affects people. And he says 9/11 fundamentally changed his field. Researchers tracking the symptoms of post-traumatic stress in New Yorkers during the months after the terrorist attacks found a surprising trend. George Bonanno explains all of this in his new book called The End of Trauma, How the New Science of Resilience is Changing How We Think About PTSD. Bonanno is a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University's Teachers College, and he's with me now. Professor Bonanno, welcome. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, what about 9/11 as a traumatic event made it useful for studying PTSD to begin with, as opposed to other traumatic events that people experience in their lives?
Well, I think that it was such a large scale event, and it was just completely ripe for, you know, everybody wanted to help, of course, including myself. But as soon as we, in a sense, so to speak, the dust settled — that's a bad metaphor — but as soon as, you know, we began to pull ourselves together, it became readily apparent that this was a very important event, and an event we could track and study to see how people would do.
And the studying started right away. And in fact, there were lots and lots of media reports, lots and lots of hand-wringing. In fact, you know, FEMA, the government, allocated a whole bunch of money because everyone assumed that there would just be like an epidemic of PTSD post 9/11.
Yes. Yes. And I think a lot of that came from the early reports. And that was, in fact, one of the lessons that this really unfortunate event taught us, that and the world was watching, you know, so there was a lot of reason to get the information out quickly. But in the first, say, you know, a few weeks or a month after an event like this, we would expect to see — we now know this very clearly — we would expect to see a lot of distress, a lot of symptoms that look like trauma, not only in the people deeply affected by the attack, but all across the country, and perhaps in different places in the world, but for sure across the country, there was a lot of distress. And that led to this wide-scale idea that everybody was traumatized, that people are traumatized, people are falling apart across the country. And that's just simply not the right interpretation of those findings.
What are those symptoms? What were we seeing?
Intrusive thoughts, nightmares, a sense of being on edge and highly aroused, a sense of really almost confusion. Most of those are trauma symptoms. And what we've learned in the interim, and I think this was already underway, people were learning this already, but it really was constellated after 9/11 because so much research, so much attention was focused. And it turns out that, and this is what a big part of my new book is about, that when something, you know, really unexpected, really horrific, something that we really dread happening, it's sudden, it's intense, we feel we're going to be deeply harmed, those are classic traumatic events. And those events in almost anybody causes these kind of reactions. They're not actually symptoms because they're not yet symptoms of a disorder. They're just stress reactions. And it's quite adaptive, actually, to have intrusive thoughts and nightmares about something really nasty that happens to you. That's your mind trying to make sense of it. And usually that runs its course. Usually it does its job and then kind of dissipates, goes away. And in fact, that's what happened after 9/11 for many people.
Most people?
Most people, absolutely. Most people. There were people who developed PTSD, and unfortunately, some of the people who were highly exposed in the towers and got out, some of the people who were injured, a pretty good chunk, between, you know, 15, 20, and 30% of those people developed PTSD. But other than that, the vast majority of people, certainly in New York and across the country, did not develop PTSD, even though they thought they were going to develop PTSD. And I've tracked many, many groups of people across, in response to all kinds of events, hurricanes, disasters, terrorist attacks, military combat. And we see the same pattern in all of them. And actually 30% PTSD is about as high as we've ever seen. Usually it's around 10%, sometimes 15, 20. And some of the people who experienced 9/11 firsthand, some groups, it was 10% if you look at different kinds of experiences. And I think people who were injured in the attack, on average across these studies, is around 26%. And some people, it was 10%, depending on the kind of exposure. And I know the expectation at the time was that, you know, everybody will be traumatized. And in fact, that is not the case. It's not what we find across study after study.
So what is the pattern? Draw for us, create a mental picture for us of what the, I guess, what the data look like when people, a large group of people experience trauma.
Yeah. Well, the typical patterns, if we look at the data, are that the majority of people, usually it's, if we look across all the different studies we've conducted, and we recently did a review on this, it's around 2/3 of the people exposed to really just about any kind of event will show what we're calling a resilience trajectory. They will basically be psychologically okay. They won't be psychologically harmed as early as 1 month after the event.
And is that true even if, even in people who've sustained injury as a result of the trauma?
We did one study in an emergency department of for people who came in for traumatic injuries. We did another long-term study, when it was true then. We did another study of people who were hospitalized for a spinal cord injury. Everybody in the study was paralyzed, permanently paralyzed. And I think, I don't remember the exact percentage in that study, but it was again the majority. And we saw no evidence of lasting symptoms really at any point. I don't think we got the data until sometime around a month, but we saw no evidence of lasting symptoms in any of those people, any of this group of the majority response after that 1 month. Hmm. And these are people lying in bed with initially they're in bad shape, they're permanently paralyzed, and yet they're basically not feeling lasting psychological symptoms.
Well, surely they have bad days, or they might even have bouts of depression when they're doing...
I think that's true for everybody in the world.
Okay, so the distinction you're making is that what would a severely traumatized lasting effect look like?
Okay, so there. You asked me about the patterns. That's the most dominant pattern we see, study after study. There's another pattern which we call recovery. We've called it different things, but it's basically a recovery pattern where people do show high levels of trauma symptoms, and they do show them after 1 month, but they gradually recover. Sometime within the first year, they kind of show this downward slope of fewer and fewer trauma symptoms. And then finally, we see the group of people who unfortunately have high levels of PTSD that do not go away. Sometimes it's several years at least, and they're still having high levels of PTSD symptoms. A lot of intrusive thoughts, a lot of nightmares, a high level of arousal, sense of confusion, uncertainty, the sense of really dread that this thing will happen again, and they're having flashbacks, the classic idea of flashbacks. And for those people, getting through their daily life becomes very difficult, and they typically need some help.
I'm speaking with George Bonanno, who is a clinical professor of psychology at Teachers College, Columbia University, author of The End of Trauma, How the New Science of Resilience is Changing How We Think About PTSD. Can we predict who will be on the resilience trajectory versus the trauma PTSD trajectory?
Well, Julie, that is a fantastic question. And I've puzzled over this for most of my career, because we don't do a very good job of predicting who will be resilient and who not. Again, there's kind of this growing assumption as we've begun to think, well, maybe PTSD isn't as common. You see everywhere in the media and even in professional discussions, the five magic traits of resilience, or, you know, the magic bullets to be resilient. And unfortunately, none of those really do a very good job of predicting who will be resilient. And this is something I've puzzled over for a long time, till I think I finally began to see the light, or at least work it out a little bit, that it's really these, none of these things, nothing is always effective. There are certain traits that help us to do what needs to be done to be resilient. Optimism is one. Sense of confidence and our ability to cope is another. And in the thinking about events as challenges, that's called challenge orientation. Those three traits tend to combine to form what I call the flexibility mindset. And that what that does is that gets us into the game. It gets us focused on what happened to us and thinking about what we need to do. By themselves, those traits will not make us resilient, and they don't predict resilience very well. But they're useful in kind of an intermediary step. And then what we need to do then is figure out what we need to do in this event. We need to work it out at that point. And that's really the challenge of dealing with a traumatic stress, is that we need to understand what's happening to me right now and what do I need to do that's going to help me get through. And we all do this when we go through one of these events.
Would you tell us about Marin? And how she did that?
Yes. Right. So Marin is one of the people in my book. And she had intelligent, attractive German woman who went to Cambridge. And she went for a weekend with a boyfriend, a weekend riding with a new boyfriend. And she was thrown off the horse. She's a reasonably good rider. Before she knew it, she was lying on her back in the field, unable to move. And she was basically paralyzed. She couldn't walk. The doctors thought she would not walk again, but she was an internally optimistic person. And that optimism didn't make her resilient, didn't make allow her to walk again, but it allowed her to actively embrace what had happened to her. And she was determined, I am going to walk again. Let me at it. What do I need to do here? And every single problem that came up, from, you know, stopping the spasms in her leg to, you know, finding ways to distract herself when she needed to, you know, finding someone who might treat her a certain way. She, all of those things were fueled by optimism, because she was always trying to solve the problem at hand. And she ultimately did walk again. She was able to walk in Cambridge on her own two legs 2 years later. And it's kind of a remarkable story. She just kept trying. She worked very hard. And, you know, ultimately she ended up in Hawaii because there was somebody there who felt that they could help her with a kind of a traditional massage. She went swimming in the ocean because that strengthened her. You know, she tried whatever she could. She ultimately could walk with a walker. Mm-hmm. And she did that to strengthen herself. You know, and many people might have stopped short of these very intense and demanding challenges, but she was so optimistic that she was going to be able to walk, that she went through all these things, and ultimately she was able to walk.
And by contrast, I found the story that you tell of an individual named Jed perhaps even more inspiring than Marin's, because he did not have a miraculous recovery, and yet he also demonstrated resilience.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Jed began with an incredibly unfortunate accident. He was in New York City working in a restaurant, and he was run over by a sanitation truck in around 1:30 in the morning. And he just got out of work from the restaurant, and he had a hoodie on, and he saw the white walk signal, walked out in the intersection. There was nobody around. All of a sudden, a sanitation truck came out of nowhere, made a right turn, which is illegal in New York on red, and knocked him over. He fell, he kind of was sucked under the front wheel of the truck, and the front wheel ran over his left leg and crushed it, you know, horribly. But there were two double axle wheels in the back of that truck, and then they each ran over his leg. And after the truck passed him, his just was a bloody mess on the street. He was screaming wildly. And the ambulance was delayed. They finally got there. They brought him in the hospital, and they immediately put him under. And they decided that he's going to be in the hospital for a long time. And they kept him in a medically induced coma for about 6 weeks. everybody in his family was deeply distressed, deeply worried. How would he react when they brought him in a coma, and when he saw his leg was missing? When he came out of the coma, it was a little fuzzy for a few days, actually. It took a while. And then he told me in we did multiple interviews that he kind of knew on some level that his leg was already gone. And within a few days, you know, he had a rush of symptoms, memories of this horrible event flooding him. And within a few days, it all just kind of disappeared. And he said, like, basically, why was I doing okay? He assumed then that everybody like gets PTSD, and he would too. But he didn't. In only 2 days, he was okay. And that, in a way, motivated him to actually go to graduate school in psychology, because he wanted to understand. But then, if I could still go on a little bit about Jed, because his story is absolutely fascinating. Several years later, he got married. He had some children. He was living the best life he could he had basically part of his hip and his entire left leg gone. So he really couldn't walk with a prosthesis very well. So he had these, you know, kind of brace crutches, and he got around really well, and quite fast, actually. And then he was having phantom limb pain. Mm. Phantom limb pain is basically signals from your whatever's left of the nerve, and it's kind of, they're kind of random signals. So your brain thinks you still have a leg, and it's very it induces very painful reactions. It's not a pleasant experience. So after, I think, 5 years or so of this phantom limb pain, 6 years, Jed decided to try to have different treatments to make it go away. One of those treatments was kind of an experimental treatment and nicked the dura layer, the outside layer on his spine. And that led to a leakage of cerebral spinal fluid. The cerebral spinal fluid is the fluid that encases the spine, but also your brain. It's one system and it's the same fluid. And when that happened, he basically became foggy, got massive headaches because his brain was not in enough of that fluid. He could only lie down. Sat up from bed, he got massive headaches and got dizzy and nauseous. It was quite a horrible experience. So for several years, he was like that. And he basically, you know, he had this horrible thing. He now had a newborn son. He was doing a PhD and he had to abandon that. And it was just dreadful. He stopped seeing his friends and relatives. He stopped seeing me. I was his mentor at that time, because he just could not talk to other people. He was too foggy and too confused. Ultimately, he tried several other treatments to fix that problem, and none of them really worked. He had these massive headaches. And ultimately, he decided, so he's really struggling with a long, drawn-out problem, in addition to the loss of his leg, which had happened 6 years earlier. And at some point, he decided, this is my new normal. I'm just going to have to deal with it. I'm going to have to figure out how I can get back in my life with this problem. And he slowly tried to work out different things that would help him deal with his life now. And so again, this whole problem of there are no magic bullets. He couldn't read the article about the 5 magic bullets of resilience, the 5 magic traits of resilient people, use those and get himself back on track. He had to find out through hard work and trial and error, and sometimes painful trial and error, what works best for his situation. And he did that. He did it over a several year period, and he's back in business now. He's actually finished his PhD. And he's now doing was hired by a well-known research hospital in New York, and he's doing clinical work and research there, and they love him there.
But still experiencing the debilitating headaches, and it's just that he was able to, he's found a way to live with it, which is amazing.
He's found a way even to live with the headaches. He learned, for example, that if he exercised a little bit, that didn't help, but then he found in certain situations, exercise would help him. Mm-hmm. He's discovered at one point that if he lie down for 15 minutes at different points in the daytime, he could keep the headaches at bay. And he's, you know, tried various things like that. He found a doctor ultimately who shared this vision, you know, try it and see what works. And ultimately, she helped him to try different things and suggested some new things for him. And it was the same story again. He would just try them and see if they worked. If they did, he kept them in his repertoire. If not, he tried other things. Hmm. And he's doing pretty well right now.
And so the traits that you have to activate that are part of a flexibility mindset then that can engage your resilience abilities, the optimism you described with Marin, confidence in coping, and viewing all of these obstacles as challenges, I guess,
yes.
rather than...
Yes, exactly. That's it. And Jed certainly had those characteristics. He's optimistic. I don't think he's nearly as optimistic as Marin, but he's optimistic. He's definitely confident in his ability to take on tasks. And he's become more confident over the years because he has taken on some pretty difficult situations. And he definitely, most definitely decided when he realized it wasn't going to change, he definitely decided to view this as, event as a challenge. So those three traits, as I mentioned, they help cultivate this flexibility mindset. It doesn't even matter if we have those traits. Some people may not have those traits. The mindset is what's important. The mindset that I'm going to figure out how to do this and I'm going to do it. That's the mindset. That mindset then gets us, as I said, into the game. I like that aphorism, but there, you know, might be others. But once we're at that point, then I also worked on this idea called the flexibility sequence. And that are really the steps that we go through. And it turns out most people do this without really quite being aware of it. We first look at the situation. We look at the problem. We kind of ask ourselves, all right, what's happening? What do I need to do? What is the problem right here, right now? Not the bigger problem. The bigger problem is he has debilitating headaches that he nauseous and he can't get up out of bed. That's the bigger problem. The immediate problem is always what's happening right now. Maybe I can find a way where I can get up a little bit. Maybe I can find a way to make these headaches go temporarily. You know, there's always the one problem that you can manage. And it gives us confidence. It takes us away from this horrific future down to what's happening right now. What can I do? Once we figure out, once we determine what we think the problem is, then we just, you know, we know what we need to do. However, the second step in this sequence is our repertoire. Not everybody has the same sort of tools in their toolbox, if I may. So, you know, we decide, okay, I need to do something here. I kind of know what I have to do, but what am I able to do here from what I have in my toolbox? We try something. Most of the time, if we'd get it right, it'll work, but oftentimes it doesn't. What we just tried didn't work. And that's the third step of the sequence where we kind of evaluate it. We don't just stop there. We evaluate it and we decide for ourselves, well, did it work? If not, we'd try something else. If it worked kind of, maybe we need to tweak it a little bit. And then we just keep cycling through this, you know, over and over. And as we encounter new problems, as we try to solve this problem. And, you know, there's a lot more detail about that sequence in the book, but it's basically, you know, this simple idea that we now have to solve this problem we have at hand. What's going to work?
The book is called The End of Trauma: How the New Science of Resilience is Changing How We Think About PTSD. It's written by George Bonanno, who is a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Teachers College. Professor Bonanno, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, revisiting the recommendation for how much vitamin C you need daily. Just ahead, the unexpected power of making a simple compliment to someone. You are tuned to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. It's nice to have you with us. What holds you back from complimenting somebody? Do you worry it'll be awkward, or maybe that they'll take it the wrong way? Or maybe you don't bother because words are cheap, and what good are those, hey, I like your shirt, kinds of comments anyway, really? But you have more influence than you think, says Cornell University social psychologist Vanessa Bohns. That is the title of her new book, which is all about the ways our words and even just our presence influence others for better or worse. Professor Bohns, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Describe an experiment that you've done assessing how compliments affect people.
Yeah, so my colleague Erica Boothby and I have done several experiments where we basically bring our participants into the lab and we tell them to go out into the world and compliment strangers. Now, before they do this, we ask them how good they think that compliment is going to make these people feel. And then they go out and do it. They bring an envelope with a survey where we ask the actual people who were complimented how the compliment made those people feel. So they go up to people, give a compliment. We even tell them what to compliment them on. We say, just tell them, hey, I like your shirt. So they randomly pick someone, hey, I like your shirt. By the way, will you fill out the survey? And then the people fill out the survey, bring it back to the lab, and we look at whether people underestimated how good the compliment would make the other person feel. And that's exactly what we find. So people think that it won't make them feel as good as it actually does.
I mean, does it make somebody feel really good to have a stranger come up and be like, hey, I like your shirt?
It does. And, huh. You know, so we started with the shirt, but we also asked them to find something else that they genuinely thought was, you know, nice about the other person and to compliment that them on that as well. And that also made them feel better than our participants expected.
Why do you think we are inclined to undervalue something as simple as saying, hey, I like your shirt?
So one thing we do is we focus on how sort of awkwardly and inarticulately we may deliver our compliment. So we think that when we go up to someone, you know, we're going to make it weird, that we might be bothering the other person. Mm-hmm. And actually, when we ask our participants how the other person will feel, they actually think the other person is going to feel kind of annoyed to be stopped by this person. But in fact, people don't care that much about how articulately someone is complimenting you. In the end, if someone's saying something nice about you, you don't really care how they're doing it. You just kind of feel good about it.
And the words don't even really matter that much.
Yeah, it's, you know, the idea is basically, I noticed you. I appreciate something about you. And so whatever it happens to be that you're complimenting that person on, it just feels good to be sort of seen and appreciated.
Is there such a thing as overdoing it when it comes to compliments?
So it's interesting. A couple of other researchers, Nick Epley and Xuan Zhao, have looked at whether basically people get sort of bored of being complimented and it just doesn't have the same sort of impact over time. And they had participants in a study come up with 5 compliments that they could give a friend. And what they did is they doled these compliments out over a course of 5 days. So over the course of 5 days, they complimented this friend on a different thing. And it turns out that even though they thought these compliments would get kind of old over time, it turns out when you're getting the compliment, you're happy to get it each day. You don't sort of get bored at being told how great you are in a different way every day. Yet we tend to think that people are going to think that we're sort of sucking up or just annoying them.
Yeah. That's interesting because I'm sure that the participants who were worried about overdoing it or is it going to be awkward? I don't want to say this. How weird this is going to be. Probably if someone else did it to them, they would be having all the same reaction that you're describing where, you know, they would feel good. It wouldn't really matter. Of course, they're not going to be annoyed or angry. Like you can stop me all day long and tell me I'm great.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's exactly what's going on is when we're in one position, right? We're in the position of having to go up to someone. We're feeling awkward. We've got to go approach a stranger, or we're trying to think of how to say something to a friend, for example. When we're in that position, we have a hard time imagining what that other person is feeling. But if we were in that person's position, we'd feel the exact same way. We'd just be happy to get this compliment.
So one lesson here is that you should never miss an opportunity to compliment someone.
Yeah.
On the other hand, though, sometimes it can be weird or be misinterpreted. I mean, there is a line. So how do you compliment in a way that that will work?
Yes, exactly. So at the end of the day, you know, you shouldn't miss an opportunity to compliment someone on something that makes them feel respected and appreciated. But as you said, there's a line, right? You can imagine all sorts of situations where we wouldn't say, oh, yeah, just give compliments, you know, indiscriminately. For example, you can think of catcalling, which is a particularly, you know, harmful form of complimenting and probably isn't really complimenting in the end at all. So the big thing is that compliments should still be appropriate to the context and show that someone is valued and respected in that context. So to give an example, a boss complimenting an employee on their work performance or a presentation that they gave can be really beneficial. And in fact, studies have shown that it can be just as beneficial as, you know, a monetary incentive, getting this nice word from your boss. But at the same time, in that context, it probably is less appropriate for a boss to be complimenting an employee on, for example, their appearance.
Yeah.
It's just not as appropriate in that context.
Now, you did this research on adults. Do you have any idea if this also extends to children, the importance of compliments?
Oh, that's a good question. These are all adults, but I would imagine that it would be similar in children, but I can't say for sure.
Hmm. So compliments are one aspect that you cover in your book. You have more influence than you think. And the title kind of says it all, but it's counterintuitive when you get into some of the details. So describe another situation in which we are inclined to underestimate our influence on other people.
So we have other studies where instead of sending people out and having them give someone something, for example, a compliment, we have them go out and ask for something, so like a favor. And it turns out that a lot of the same dynamics are in play in those situations as well. So when we're in the position of needing to go up to somebody, we're so focused on our own anxieties and, in this case, our fear of rejection if we're asking someone for something, that we don't realize the other person's perspective, that they're often quite happy to help us out and that they find it pretty hard to say no when we ask for something.
But are they happy to help us out, though, or do they just have a hard time saying no?
It's a little bit of both. Yeah. So in the end, it's hard to say no in the moment when someone's standing there asking you for something, for sure. And we find that that drives a lot of our findings. But then pretty quickly afterwards, we convince ourselves that we did that not because it was hard to say no, but because we're really, you know, kind and warm and helpful people.
Mm. But there's a dark side to that, because you also find that that we can use our power for ill. I mean, people are going to say yes even to things that they don't really want to do or that are not safe or even lawful.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when we ask someone for something, they find it really hard to say no. And if it's a favor or something helpful, in the end, it works out okay and everyone feels good. But in other studies, we've had our participants ask people to do things that are unethical or inappropriate. So, for example, we've had them go out and ask people to vandalize library books. And in that case as well, people say yes more than our participants think. And it's because it's so hard for them to say no. So they wind up doing this thing they actually feel really uncomfortable doing because they find it even more uncomfortable to say no.
You and I have actually spoken previously, Professor Bonds, in the context of sexual harassment and consent. Give us an example of a situation where people have more power than they think, and it skews the way that we interpret the situation.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. So these same dynamics play out, as you said, in these sort of Me Too contexts, right? So in cases, for example, where a coworker might be interested in a fellow coworker and feel like they want to ask them out, but that person isn't interested, we tend to think when we're the ones doing the asking that if the other person doesn't want to go out with us, they'll just say no, end of story. It'll be pretty easy for them to say no. But in fact, what the research shows is that it's quite hard for people to say no, even in these kinds of situations when someone's asking you out on a date and you're not interested. And so what happens is if you ask somebody out, you assume, oh, they just said no, you know, they'll move on and go about their lives. But in fact, that impacts that other person in a lot of ways. For example, they might start avoiding the person who asked them out. They might start, you know, making changes in their workplace because they feel uncomfortable. And so in the end, that simple sort of, I just went for it and asked somebody out, can have these sort of longer term effects and really impact people in ways we don't always see.
Speaking with Vanessa Bonds, who's a professor of social psychology at Cornell University, author of You Have More Influence Than You Think. We talked about compliments and how even the simplest compliment of the most mundane thing can actually be meaningful. What about the flip side, words that are harmful that we don't realize?
Yeah, so at the same time as, you know, a compliment can sort of brighten someone's day more than we realize, certain words that are particularly hurtful can also hurt someone even more than we realize. So we all have these sort of comments someone's made to us that sort of reverberate in our heads long after the fact. Many of us can look back, you know, months or years and say, I can't believe this person said that. I always think about that. But that means that when we make a comment, the same thing can happen. So when we say something, you know, insensitive, for example, that comment can be something that reverberates in somebody else's head and have even more negative impact than we might imagine.
You also talk about how you don't have to say a word and you can be influential in a situation. Can you share an example of that?
Sure. So there's something called the invisibility cloak illusion. And that's basically this idea that we walk around feeling like no one's kind of paying attention to us and we're wearing an invisibility cloak. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is we don't realize when other people sort of notice what we're wearing or what we're doing, and then in turn mimic that down the road. Or if we're in a meeting, we don't realize the extent to which just our mere presence in that meeting can shape the way the other people in that meeting are discussing a topic because they notice us more than we realize. So even without saying anything, we're impacting the discussions that happen around us because people do notice us and they have ideas about sort of how we would respond to something and they adjust what they talk about and what they do accordingly.
What advice do you have for how to become more aware of your influence without becoming self-conscious and self-absorbed all at the same time? Like all of a sudden I'm thinking everyone's looking at me. People are noticing everything I say and do. And that's kind of paralyzing as well.
Absolutely. So I think one sort of factor in all this is that when we look out of the world, we're always looking out through our own two eyes and we're seeing everything happening around us. We're seeing the things other people are saying to us that's impacting us. We're seeing the things other people are saying to one another that are impacting them. But the thing we don't see when we look out at the world is ourselves and the way the things we do and we say could be eliciting responses in the other people around us. And so one of the suggestions I have is to find a way to get out of your own head. And that could be just by sort of pretending you're a fly on the wall and picturing a scene that you're in from a third-party perspective and sort of seeing how the things you might be doing and you might be saying are impacting other people. And that can make you feel better or worse. It can make you realize things that you're saying that, you know, you don't intend that could come across harmfully or upsetting to somebody. It could also mean that you see that actually I wouldn't be that hard on myself. I think I'm doing just fine. But it helps you sort of get a better sense of what would somebody else looking at what I'm doing, how would they interpret my actions and how they're sort of shaping the context around me.
Vanessa Bons is a professor of social psychology at Cornell, and the book is You Have More Influence Than You Think. Thanks for your time today, Professor.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, how much vitamin C do you really need? The definitive study on it was done more than 70 years ago. Now it's getting a fresh look. I'm Julie Rose. It is good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Most of us think of vitamin C as an immunity booster during cold and flu season. But the most well-documented benefit of vitamin C in the human body is actually for healing wounds, creating scar tissue, and keeping the walls of blood vessels intact. The global standard for how much vitamin C a person should consume each day needs an update, says Philippe Ujoel. He is a professor of oral health at the University of Washington, and he's with us now to talk about his research. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me, Julie.
Explain the biology of vitamin C. How does it work in the body?
Well, vitamin C is an important cofactor for building collagen. So if you don't have sufficient vitamin C, the collagen that's being built is not very stable. And so that has an impact on what they call collagen-related pathologies that may have an impact on the integrity of your blood vessel walls. And also it has an impact on wound healing.
What are the signs that a person has vitamin C deficiency?
Well, that's a very good question in the sense that the signs are typically subtle. So I would say the most important sign for a vitamin C deficiency in the beginning is gingival bleeding. It's kind of the classical symptom of a lack of vitamin C that sets on pretty quickly.
Gingival, so you say gingival, you mean that's gums, right?
That's correct. Sorry. Yeah, gum bleeding.
Okay.
The other frequent kind of initial side effect is tiredness. So those are the two very first signs that you will see if you didn't have enough vitamin C for, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks.
Why would you have fatigue?
That's a very good question. So it is also, vitamin C has many functions and it has long been known, from the time of scurvy, that, you know, these people that get the frank symptoms of scurvy, which you only get like after 9 months, get extremely tired. So it has to do with their energy production.
Scurvy. What is scurvy?
Well, scurvy, I mean, more people have died of scurvy than of any other nutritional deficiency except starvation. So hundreds of thousands of sailors died of scurvy in the Middle Ages. It's a disease where that typically after 7 to 8 months, the prime symptoms were always described as dental. People start losing their teeth. They start bleeding from their gums. And then typically they have a very sudden death. You know, it's basically a blood vessel that ruptures. And, you know, there's these stories of sailors that die in mid-sentence because of a stroke.
Right, because the vitamin C is a building block for blood vessel walls. And so
correct.
You can have a rupture. Okay. And now vitamin C, does the body make its own?
No, that's why it's called a vitamin. So some many, many millions of years ago, in evolution, somewhere in the branches, you know, people lost the ability to make vitamin C. And so, no, we cannot make vitamin C. We need to have it from our diet.
You have, Dr. Ujjwal, been going back over some historic research that established the kind of gold standard, the daily recommendation for how much of that vitamin C we need to be consuming. It was done at a famous research facility in England. This was during World War II. Tell us about Sorby. What were they doing there?
So it's a they were doing deprivation studies. So prior to the vitamin C study, they were looking at vitamin A. And when that study was done, they decided to start looking at vitamin C because there was a lot of vitamin C deficiency in England and they didn't really have a good sense as to how much vitamin C you need. So they had 20 volunteers. Most of them were conscientious objectors. And they started the deprivation. In other words, they assigned 10 of these subjects to basically an intake of vitamin C, which was 1 milligram or less. So way below what we know is needed on a daily basis. At the very minimum, people in those days were thinking, you know, you need like 30 to 40 milligrams. So the goal of this experiment, which is, you know, incomprehensible from today's perspective, maybe was to induce scurvy. So they put 20 people on either 0 milligram of vitamin C, 10 milligrams of vitamin C, and then they put 3 people as a control on 70 milligrams of vitamin C. And so they went 8 to 9 months. So no other study has ever been done that's of such a duration until they saw the frank signs of scurvy. In other words, the clinician said, yes, there is scurvy. They have spots on their backs. They have bleeding gums. The wound healing is not going well. When they had these, they had what they call scorbutic wounds. And when they saw those signs, they said, okay, we better stop. And then they started seeing, you know, how much do we need now to cure the scurvy? So if you think about all the vitamin C studies that are done, this is the only one of such a duration, which makes it unique.
Right, because for ethical reasons today, you could never get approval to take healthy people and make them desperately sick by withholding vitamin C.
Correct. I think today at the very most, you can go for 30 days without vitamin C. And, you know, after that, it becomes kind of questionable whether you can do it.
Mm. So what did the study find then, this unusual, although extreme, research?
I think they found several kind of very important findings. The first one is that it takes quite a long time before you get the clinical symptoms of scurvy. So it takes 8 to 9 months before you see scurvy. I think the other thing which this study showed, which is kind of very scary, is that the 2 people got acute heart problems. It's hard to go back now in time and see exactly what were these heart problems, but clearly the investigators were very kind of like, you know, very worried and suddenly gave these people 3 grams of vitamin C because clearly it was a clinical emergency. These people were short of breath, their heartbeat was irregular. And so the fact that you do see these life-threatening symptoms appear after 8 to 9 months is something which in an experimental setting has never been shown before and has never been shown again. The other thing which they saw is that, you know, one of the classical things of scurvy apart from bleeding gums was poor wound healing. So if you go back to the Middle Ages, they would talk about scars that opened up again. And so they did see that indeed scars after a 7 to 8 months of vitamin C deprivation, they didn't heal properly anymore. You could see these scar wounds starting to open a little bit, and you could see bleeding starting to happen within the wounds. Mm. So one of the amazing things to me is this study was done in 1944. It lasted until 1946. And in those days, they took color pictures of everything. They documented it. They published it. So it's quite an amazing kind of observation that in those days, which was still, you know, it was towards the end of the war, that they already had such good documentation of everything that was happening.
And so out of this, these conclusions then comes a standard for vitamin C, like what's a safe, what's a recommended daily dose effectively, right? And what was the number that came out of that study?
So that's correct. So in that study, they had 7 people and they put them on 10 milligrams of vitamin C and they never saw the onset of scurvy. This is the clinical condition of scurvy. They did see capillary fragility. They did see evidence, you know, of one wound not closing well, but they said we never see frank clinical scurvy on the people on 10 milligrams. And then they arbitrarily increased it threefold and they said, you know, because of to take into account that some people may have a higher vitamin C need, et cetera. And so out of that study came this kind of standard to recommend around 30 milligrams of vitamin C. And so, for instance, the World Health Organization is very close that as they recommend roughly 45 milligrams of vitamin C. But it's a very common recommendation you will see, which is kind of discrepant from other institutions like the National Academy of Medicine recommends roughly double that.
Right. So you went back and reanalyzed using modern statistical methods, the data from this 1944 study. And what did you find? What was your conclusion?
So the conclusion was that, number one, it really looks like if you want to have healthy collagen, what really matters is your average vitamin C intake. So let's say if you go deficient for 4 to 5 months, you have a very low vitamin C intake. I think it's a mistake to think that, oh, I'm going to take, you know, a couple of gram now for 2 weeks and everything will be fine. It really takes a long time before collagen-related pathologies restore and become normal again. So that was one kind of major finding. The second important finding is that the people that didn't have, you know, an average of 70 to 80 milligrams of vitamin C intake, they did have weaker wounds. So the people on 10 milligrams of vitamin C, which up until now was believed to be adequate, they did have a weaker scar strength.
Oh, so the World Health Organization recommendation of 30 to 45 milligrams of vitamin C a day may be enough to prevent serious scurvy, but you're not getting as much benefit. You should be taking maybe double that in order to really be getting the benefit for wound healing and scar
Correct.
Tissue.
Correct. So 45 milligrams of vitamin C, which is what the World Health Organization recommends, does not appear to be sufficient to lead to normal wound healing, to a normal scar strength. And also it does not appear to be sufficient to prevent gingival bleeding. Mm. So the World Health Organization, when they make this recommendation, they kind of try to take into account, you know, that you may go, for instance, in the winter months when there is less natural vitamin C may be in your dietary intake, you should be able to go for a couple of weeks without vitamin C and still be fine. And if you look at gingival bleeding and you look at wound healing, it looks like that's not okay. It looks like the recommendation of the National Academy of Medicine, for instance, is more optimal, roughly 100 milligrams a day.
Roughly 100 milligrams a day is the optimal
Correct.
Amount. And how do I get that? What is vitamin C in?
So there is lots of good sources of vitamin C. I mean, so the classical one is citrus fruit, where you have about 50 milligrams per 100 grams. Kale,
so,
peppers.
So I'd have to wait. So I'd have to eat like 2 large oranges a day in order to get 100 milligrams?
I think roughly, if I remember right, a citrus fruit, an orange, has roughly 30 milligrams. So if you eat 2 of them, you're still kind of on the low side.
Okay. Oh, gosh. All right. So it's in what else?
Kale, peppers, strawberries, black currants is very high. That may be one of the highest. Brussels sprouts. And so one thing which I think is important is that if you are on a low carbohydrate diet, if you try to avoid, you know, intake of carbohydrates, intake of sugars, you don't have that many choices to get your vitamin C. So you can then go to kale, which is very low in carbohydrates. And, you know, it's roughly 120 milligrams per 100 grams of kale. So kale is a wonderful source to get a low carbohydrate. In other words, very low in sugar and yet very high in vitamin C. You can have peppers, which is also very high. It's roughly 140 milligrams per 100 grams of peppers. Brussels sprouts.
What about supplements?
Yeah, so that's what I am very much kind of, you know, a skeptic of taking supplements. But if you are on a low carbohydrate diet and you don't like peppers and you're not very fond of kale, it can be hard. So it can be, you know, for people that try to avoid sugars and don't like to eat kale, a supplement may be something to consider.
Yeah. I feel like I know a lot of people that don't eat oranges and citrus and kale. And I'm like, why don't we all have scurvy? It seems strange to me. It must be in a lot of other things, like as a, like our processed foods as an additive.
So it is in potatoes. So if you have a you know, French fries, you know, you'll have probably enough vitamin C. So the key thing to remember there is that you don't really have a lot of symptoms if you have a very low vitamin C intake. So if you take like 10 to 20 milligrams of vitamin C, you will not get scurvy. I mean, and you have to eat that kind of diet. And even if you eat it for, you know, 9 months, that's what the study in Sorby showed. You know, you will not get the symptoms of vitamin C.
But you're also not getting the full benefit. Philippe Joël is a professor of oral health at the University of Washington. Thanks a lot for your time today, doctor.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First this hour, the enduring impact of Sesame Street.
You taught me that all kinds of people can get along, and I never knew that could happen in life.
We'll hear how the makers of Sesame Street decided what they would teach to kids. Then, instead of tossing those flimsy plastic shopping bags in the trash, how about turning them into clothing? That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. For 50 years, kids have been learning along with Big Bird, Elmo, Grover, Oscar the Grouch, Cookie Monster. How has Sesame Street managed such staying power?
Sunny days, sweeping the clouds away. On my way to where the air is sweet. Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street?
It's entertaining. It's high quality. It's got Muppets. And it's backed by a lot of research. As the science of child development progressed over the last 50 years, Sesame Street has evolved in subtle ways to stay in touch with preschoolers and their parents. Lucille Burbank worked on Sesame Street's research team for a decade and wrote a book called The Inside Secrets of Sesame Street. She's with me now. Lucille Burbank, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Oh, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you. What exactly was your job as part of Sesame Street's research team?
Well, it was really to go out and do research on preschoolers, find out what was working, what they were comprehending, what they were attending to, and then making recommendations to the head writer, changing the script sometimes. But it was mainly just, and you know, just mainly writing up research, going out. We'd use those checker cabs and we'd go out to all sorts of schools and do all sorts of research and using materials too to make sure that they're comprehending or to see if they're comprehending. And then we'd change what wasn't working. And also meeting with the head writer was very important so we could make important changes in the script.
So what was an example? What's an example of something that got changed because of research?
Oh, okay. So there was one piece we were doing on cooperation. And the producers are saying they always like humor. And so they were exiting the segment or the block or episode with something like, cooperation doesn't pay off, or it will not, or something like that. Some kind of fun thing. Mm-hmm. And the research team came in and said, hey, we need you to show that cooperation does work, why it works, and we need to exit in a fun way with showing that. So they went back to the drawing board and they said, they're right, because if we're just wishy-washy about cooperation working, it won't. And so they went back and, did it. And we had a funny kind of scene there, but it showed that cooperation is working.
Hmm. Where did this commitment to making everything research-based come from?
Oh, gosh. Sesame Street is the most researched program in the history of television. And it's not just because it's a children's show, in any show. The reason is we wanted to make sure we were able to grab the point of view of the child and make sure we were still talking to the child's point of view, keeping updated, and things that, the producers, they tend to be very intuitive and they're very good, and the writers, and they've been writing for children. But once the research came in, so many of them were surprised of, hey, things were right on, or things they thought they're going to be above their heads were right there. Things they thought that were going to be exciting or so forth didn't have the preschoolers' attention. So they were confirming kind of, or not confirming, but they were kind of grounding their intuitiveness and their experience in reality and research and evaluation.
So are you saying that episodes of Sesame Street would be produced, they'd be filmed, they'd be scripted, all that stuff, and then before it ever went on the air, it would go out to like a focus group of preschoolers to see if it worked or not?
Yeah, formative research, which means doing research ongoing. Hmm. There's summative evaluation and there's formative evaluation. Summative is after the program is produced and so forth, you evaluate it and you don't change it. That was for the federal government and for their funding, those purposes. But then there was formative evaluation that was always done. This means as it's going on, you will change it according to what you're finding out from your target audience.
You have some great stories about some of that we'll get to in a moment. But let's talk about some of the basic decisions that were made about Sesame Street right from the get-go, 1968-69. At that moment, Captain Kangaroo was on at its end, right? And Mr. Rogers was on the air at the time. What was Sesame Street trying to do that was different?
How this all started is Joan Cooney, who's the co-founder, and Lloyd Morissette, also the co-founder, had a dinner party, and they were just grappling with the situation that, hey, television is really not that great. And they were worried about it. The feeling at that time was it's a wasteland. And we had Action for Children's Television by Peggy Sharon coming in. There was the Sergeant General's big book on the violence in television. Man had walked on the moon. So it was a whole can-do in the air. So the workshop said, hey, at this dinner party, why don't we do something special? Why don't we change television? I think we can just turn it on its end. Let's have it reach its potential and educate these kids. Also, we're looking at preschool education. Head Start started at that time. but there were the Black and Hispanic and poverty children who were not going to preschool, and they were not getting a good start in school, which was important. So Joan Cooney said, hey, at that time, for a penny a child, we can teach them preschool and get them ready. And that's what they decided to do.
So Captain Kangaroo had been successful. In fact, a lot of puppeteers and writers had come over from Captain Kangaroo to work on Sesame Street. You also, meanwhile, had Mr. Rogers that was also becoming very popular. But his approach was different in some key ways from Sesame Street. And you have this funny story where you describe kind of a conflict that occurred when Big Bird was invited to come on the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood program. And Mr. Rogers, just describe kind of what the back and forth was there with Big Bird's appearance on Mr. Rogers.
Oh, that was so funny. Because can you imagine having an argument with Fred Rogers as Carol Spinney, who played, was the puppeteer for Big Bird, said to me. I said, no. And at any rate, what happened was he was asked to go on the show. And there's a big difference. In Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Fred Rogers is very, very adamant about keeping reality and fantasy separate. Very much. And there must be a big, firm dividing line between reality and fantasy. Whereas on Sesame Street, Jim Henson and the Muppets and everything, they mix reality and fantasy up all the time. So, any rate, so Fred says to Carol Spinney, I'm going to have you come in the house. This is the reality portion of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm going to introduce you and then ask you to slowly take off your costume. And Carol Spinney said, no, I can't do that. And it happened that there was a time where he had to, when he was on Sesame Street and Jim Henson was there, he had to exit his costume, or at least put his head out, because a fire was raging in the studio and he was catching on fire. And Jim Henson said to him, never do that again. It'll ruin the fantasy aspect of Big Bird. I don't want to ever see that. So Carol Spinney is saying to Fred Rogers, I can't do that. No, no, no. So they're going back and forth about the marionettes and puppets. And Fred Rogers is saying, oh, but you have to. The children have to understand the difference. So finally, Carol Spinney stopped and he said, hey, why don't we do this? Let's change the script and just put me in fantasy land and it'll work out all right. So that's how it was done. But they did have the Sesame Street, did have Fred Rogers come on the show. And Fred Rogers did talk very gently and carefully about why it was important to separate reality from fantasy. So they were entertaining both points of view.
Describe why it was important for Sesame Street to blend Muppets and real world and sort of, you know, have that fantasy reality blend.
They wanted to make learning fun. And there were things that the Muppets could do that a human being couldn't do. For instance, Cookie Monster could sell his soul to the devil for a cookie. And we couldn't have a role model of a actor or actress doing that. The Count could count grains of sand forever. And there were other ways that the Muppets could make learning so entertaining and so involving just by their characterizations. You know, they're so appealing that the producers really thought, hey, you know, there's a role for them. And as time went on, the Muppets became, they didn't want them to become a star, but they really did become a star. I mean, we always have to ask someone, who's your favorite Muppet?
Yeah. Another evolution that you describe, Lucille Burbank, in your book, The Inside Secrets of Sesame Street, was the expansion of the mission of what the Sesame Street Workshop wanted to teach children. So initially, there was a heavy focus on, you know, the ABCs and the 1-2-3s, and then and reading basic words, and then they added more of the emotional intelligence piece of it, right? Social skills. And so you describe coming in at a very interesting moment in the early 80s when you began as a researcher. What was that year's sort of non-academic goal that you had to think about teaching to children?
Yeah, well, you know, it was a really courageous goal. It was exciting in terms of not what happened is Will Lee, who played Mr. Hooper's store, the storekeeper of Mr. Hooper's, you know, of the store. Will Lee, he had been acting on Sesame Street for 12 years and he died. And so usually we're dealing with cognitive numbers, shapes, letters, classification, that kind of stuff. But now we're switching to the affective side. And instead of saying, hey, he'll go on vacation or he decided to retire or whatever, the workshop decided to head on deal with death. And that was wonderful. And I always remember Fred Rogers, when I interviewed him, saying, you know, we need more honest adults in our lives, CEO. So I just felt so great in starting to work at the workshop that we were being honest with the children and we were dealing with death. We did research all on this. Each of us had a project to do, so that we could feed, Norman Stiles was the head writer at that time, we could feed them things like what happens to a child, how does that child feel when someone dies? And we would find primarily they feel like, well, oh, who will take care of me? Or in the script we say, oh, well, who... Big Bird would say, who would make my birdseed milkshake anymore? And so we would do that. Norman Stiles wrote the most beautiful script.
I'd like to listen to a bit of that episode that I have here. Okay. It really is a beautiful. Sure. So this was in the early 80s. Yeah. And it centers around Big Bird's learning about death. Big Bird, of course, is the character standing in for the toddler, the core audience of Sesame Street. And in this moment, just to kind of give people a basic background, most of the human adult participants cast are there, kind of all gathered around. And Big Bird comes in and he's showing off the pictures that he's been drawing of all of the people, all of the Sesame Street neighbors. And then he pulls out one of Mr. Hooper and they're like, oh, it's beautiful. And he says, I can't wait to show him. And then all the adults are like, but Big Bird, we told you he's dead. And he's like, well, I'll show it to him when he comes back. And then here's kind of part of that exchange.
Big Bird, when people die, they don't come back.
Ever?
No, never.
Why not?
Well, Big Bird, they're dead. They can't come back.
Well, she's gonna come back. Why, who's gonna take care of the store? And who's gonna make my birdseed milkshakes and tell me stories?
Big Bird,
I'm gonna take care of the store. Mr. Hooper, he left it to me. And I'll make you your milkshakes and we'll all tell you stories and
sure,
we'll make sure you're okay.
Sure, we'll look after you.
Oh.
It really is a lovely scene, and so interesting to hear the backstory, Lucille Burbank, of how it came together. You also describe the really interesting backstory of how Sesame Street became really maybe the first children's program to show children with developmental disabilities on camera doing normal children things. Tell us a little bit about Jason, who was actually the son of one of the writers.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Emily Pearl Kingsley, she looked at Sesame. She's the mother of Jason. And she looked at Sesame Street when it first debuted, fell in love with the show, had never been a writer. And so had to learn to be a TV writer in order to work on the show in 1970. And she's going along and she's looking at this, the Theater for the Deaf, and doing all sorts of research. And then lo and behold, she finds out that she, her son has, is born with Down syndrome. And, but this was a perfect opportunity for her to have Jason and to show people that, hey, you know, just because at that time they thought Down syndrome, you know, there wouldn't be any way of educating the child. And she, you know, said, absolutely not. So she had Jason on time and time again, showing, doing academic work and numbers and counting and so forth. And she just is such a wonderful, wonderful asset, and did a lot of special work. She got from Theater of the Deaf, she wrote the script for them. She liked them very much. So they got, she got, I've forgotten Linda something or other, who is the deaf person, person on Sesame Street. And then we got on to autism. And nowadays we have this new Muppet called Julia that does, that is autistic. And the puppeteer for her is, her son has autism, and at any rate, Julia is on. And then April is autism month, and so they'll run a number of episodes on that, and they keep expanding it and so forth. It's wonderful.
A real commitment to diversity of abilities and of and races has always been a very diverse cast, not just in the Muppet world, but obviously in the world as well of the humans that live on Sesame Street. Before we go any further, I want to hear just a quick clip. I do have a clip of one of those episodes of Jason when he was maybe 2 or 3.
And then I want to just talk a little bit about the tolerance and the range of people on Sesame Street.
I certainly will. So this is Jason when he's about 3, Jason Kingsley, and he's talking to Cookie Monster about the letter S.
What, what letter is that?
S.
S? Yeah, and what behind here?
S. Shoe.
Shoe. S. Shoe. Shoe starts with S. Very good.
I also have a quick clip of the very first episode where Julia, the Muppet with autism, was introduced.
May I see your painting, Julia? Julia?
Sometimes it takes Julia a while to answer. It helps to ask again. Julia? Hmm? Can Big Bird see your painting?
See your painting? Yes.
Okay. Oh, all right. Take a look at this, everybody.
Sesame Street really has, at least I learned from your book, Lucille Burbank, really, really has been a groundbreaker in terms of showing, you know, children with developmental disorders doing normal things and even academic things on screen. What has been driving the commitment to, you know, diversity on screen in so many different ways for Sesame Street?
Yeah, it is wonderful. You know, what little people know is that in the beginning, really, there was this professor at Harvard that was working on the board of Sesame Street. And he said, yeah, it's great for us to make learning fun and to do the academic, the cognitive material, but also this is a great way to show tolerance and all kinds of people working together. And in fact, Bob McGrath was at the Newark airport, and this lady was shouting to him and recognized him. Bob McGrath was also an original actor on Sesame Street in 1969. So he was traveling, and this black lady at the desk said, "Hi, Bob," and recognized him, and they started a dialogue and everything else. And he says, all of a sudden, "Gee, you must be very smart from watching Sesame Street. We must have taught you a lot." And she got very serious. And she said, "Yes, you did. You taught me that all kinds of people can get along. And I never knew that could happen in life." Yeah. So it was one of those beautiful moments. But that tolerance and combining all that diversity is always been one of the main goals of Sesame Street.
I'm speaking with Lucille Burbank, who for 10 years was a researcher at Sesame Street. She's author of The Inside Secrets of Sesame Street. And we have to take a really quick break here on Top of Mind. When we come back, we'll talk about the many ways that Sesame Street over the years developed techniques to keep kids engaged and also make parents stop and watch. For example, this was groundbreaking. The first celebrity guest to appear on Sesame Street. Can you guess who this voice is?
One. Two.
We'll have the answer right after we take a quick break here on Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. It's good to have you with us for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. We're talking Sesame Street, which has been on the air for more than 50 years now, entertaining generations of children and also educating them. I'm speaking with Lucille Burbank, who worked on Sesame Street's in-house child development research and science team for a decade. This is a team that really did shape and guide how Sesame Street presented knowledge and life to kids on television. Lucille Burbank is author of The Inside Secrets of Sesame Street. One of the things that you mentioned, Lucille Burbank, was how early on the writers at Sesame Street realized that, yes, kids were the target audience, especially these preschoolers, four-year-olds and younger, but you also had to appeal to parents. Why did they feel like that was important?
Because it's so important for parents to watch the television show with their children. I mean, it's always been important, but how do you get parents to do that? First of all, the sound of Sesame Street, its theme song, and the sound that came into the kitchen had to be appealing when the show started and when it came on the TV. The other thing is the scripts were written on two levels. One for the child and one for the parents. And we would incorporate jokes, parodies, satires, anything for the parents. And so the child would be looking at their mother or father and wondering why they're chuckling. Also celebrities. James Earl Jones or Burt Lancaster, he would stop. His presence would stop a parent, but it would also stop a child.
So James Earl Jones was the first celebrity guest to appear on Sesame Street. This is his voice counting. All he did was count to 10.
6, 7.
But apparently it was so effective that they had him on to do the alphabet. And then they started, the Sesame Street team started talking about the James Earl Jones effect, which was basically this getting parents to stop and pay attention kind of a moment that you described, right?
Yeah. And again, it's that presence. And they would encourage other celebrities to have that presence when they were reciting the alphabet or numbers or so forth.
Yeah.
And it is, and you know he has such a presence. Yeah. I mean, you know, and Darth Vader and all sorts of things. He has that presence.
The spoofs that you mentioned are to this day, I think, are some of the cleverest puns and play on words of various, for the most part, very adult television shows that children would not be watching, probably should not be watching in many cases, but parents will be chuckling along. I just have a couple of examples that I thought were pretty fun from over the years.
Your tea, Mom.
Thank you. Oh, why is the tea not going in my cup?
Perhaps because we are upside down, Mom.
Well, of course we are upside down. This is upside down to an Abbey.
I need 30 rocks for the rock sketch. Where are they?
Lemon! Looking for a Liz Lemon here!
Yeah, right over here.
Anybody by the name of Lemon?
That would be me.
Oh, hey, I got a delivery
yes,
for you.
Yes, do you have the 30 rocks?
Do these look like marshmallows?
Gestros needs a new king or queen. And to decide, we will play a game. A game of chess!
Huzzah!
Just a few of the many, many television spoofs that Sesame Street has done over the years, teaching basic skills to kids, but also entertaining their parents slyly as well. Lucille Burbank, early on, Sesame Street did get criticized a little bit. One of the criticisms in the late—this was, of course, the late 60s, you know, the— So with all of the kind of hippie stuff that was going on and at that time, there was some concern that it was maybe too frenetic, that it was going to somehow harm kids and their attention span. One of the things you point out that people were kind of concerned about, or at least the critics were concerned about, was this little animation that would occur in Sesame Street shows called Jazz Numbers. And it had Grace Slick, who is the lead singer of Jefferson Airplane. And it would sound something like this.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 7.
There would be this particular one had this little animation. It was a very frenetic animation of a wizard and the number seven jumping all over the screen, right?
Yeah.
How did Sesame Street address that criticism that maybe this was going to be bad?
When I asked John Stone, who was the head, he was the head writer, producer, director, executive producer. Now he's called the soul of Sesame Street. When I asked him about that, he said, you know, the show caught a bit of a virus from this and they were just so well done. But then, you know, you have to step back and you have to watch the show. And he said, yes, unfortunately. But then we were able to say to people, watch the show. Just don't go into the room and see and stay there for 2 or 3 minutes and not watch and see the modulation of the pace, the slower segments, the longer segments, the medium segments, and so forth. But it did. He did admit it did catch a little bit of a virus. We had some person, I forgot her name, crying out in Washington, D.C. or something about that everybody's going to be hyperactive or so forth from watching Sesame Street. But really, when you step back and you watch the show, it has a range of pieces. But that did not help it.
Well, there was kind of a balance that Sesame Street was and continues to walk. Kind of a fine line that you have to walk, I imagine, because on the one hand, these are toddlers and you need to keep their attention. And so things do have to change and sometimes go at a different pace in order to kind of bring them back in. But also you don't want to be making a bunch of hyperactive monsters, right? Describe that a lot of the material would go through a test. Head researcher called the distractor method. Can you describe that?
Oh, yeah, the distractor method. But the main thing is we were learning that the attention span of a preschooler was so much more than we had originally thought. Okay, so in the beginning, Joan Cooney, co-creator of Sesame Street, she said these children are learning commercials. And they can learn the jingles, they remember the words and everything. We'll use a commercial format to make learning fun and to make sure it's memorable and they remember it. Then as time went on, now Dr. Palmer, who invented the distractor method, it was quite a method. And he was also the vice president of Sesame Street Research, quite a guy. But at any rate, how this distractor method worked is we would show segments and then he would have toys there and then he would have a competing slideshow. So as we're showing the Sesame Street segment, or, you know, and we identify which segment we wanted to see, if it was working, if it was keeping the attention and so forth. And if the child played with the toys more, or, you know, looked at the slideshow more rather than the Sesame Street segment that was being shown, then he would say to the producers, okay, back to the drawing board. You get a C. I want to see an A on this for attention. He was always grading them.
There was a really formative change that research guided for the show with regard to how letters were taught.
Oh my gosh, that was really, you know, and this is one of the main, thank goodness for research. It's one of the main reasons Sesame Street is so strong on research, because you really don't know if it's going to work. And so what happened was, in the early days, in 1968, the producers, you know, they always think their intuition is great, and it was never counteracted or anything. So they produced this, I think it was the letter J, and J is up in the left-hand corner, and then this June bug is dancing in the lower right-hand corner, and so Palmer went out, and the kids did not learn the letter J. They learned all the entertainment, the lovely dance and the song and everything with the June bug dancing, but no J. And he said to them, hey, you've got to get it into the action. You just have to. So he said, combine it, make the letter a character in the action. So then we got the letter W, and we got Kermit the Frog, and Kermit the Frog is lecturing about the letter W, and the letter W is slowly coming towards Kermit the Frog, and oh my gosh, and he's coming up to him, and he's about to plummet him and take over his lecture and get in the way. And Kermit is going, oh, woe is me, woe is me. And so that whole letter and Kermit are intertwined. And Kermit is going through all sorts of W and O. And that worked.
Yeah.
That worked, because it got it, you know, as Palmer would say to me, get it in the action, integrate it. And so that's what they did.
Another key element of the learning of the teaching process for Sesame Street is repetition. And so here's just an example, kind of the epitome of that.
But just as Wanda was about to drop her wig into the warm water, a wild wind whipped the wig from her hand and blew it away forever. Which taught Wanda this lesson. Witches who wash their wigs on windy winter Wednesdays are wacky. This witch story was brought to you courtesy of the letter W.
Another important development that became core to Sesame Street's approach is was music used in an interactive way, to, even though children were sitting in front of a screen and could not literally talk to Sesame Street, or, you know, to Big Bird or their other favorite characters on Sesame Street, there was still Sesame Street innovated a kind of interactivity that you could still have, which today we kind of take for granted. I think kids are used to shows like Dora the Explorer, you know, asking a question, pausing for a moment, and then being like, that's right, you know, as if they're having a conversation. Sesame Street was really early to that game, wasn't it?
It really was. One of those things is not like the others was this classification game put to music. One of these things is not like the others.
One of these things is not like the other. One of these things just doesn't belong. Can you tell which thing?
Sorry to jump in on you there, Lucille, but there it is.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
So what's interactive? What does that song teach us about teaching kids?
Well, it's a wonderful classification song. So, you know, you could go, you know, everything has, and they would put to music any kind of goal. So if we were classifying objects of same and different shape, same and different, and so forth, that song would do it so beautifully. And everybody just had such fun, and it worked. It worked beautifully. And then the role of music, you know, there were very few dry pieces. In fact, probably hardly any at all on Sesame Street, because the role of music was so pivotal. I mean, children love music. They dance to music. It causes mental participation as well as physical participation. For instance, like the song, that beautiful song, Being Green.
It's not that easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves.
That is phenomenal, because it is causing, someday the child will learn that being green, oh, it's so hard to be green because it's the color of this and that. But then all of a sudden, it is great being green, because I'm like a tree in a beautiful mountain.
But green's the color of spring, and green can be cool and friendly like. And green could be big like an ocean, or important like a mountain, or tall like a tree.
And some child will go, hey, it's okay to be deaf, or it's okay, you know, to be black, or it's okay to be whatever I am. Mm-hmm. And that they're dealing with maybe a disability or difficulty or whatever. And that mental participation of all of a sudden you're accepting yourself, and you're saying, not only do I accept myself, but I am really great. Because, and then they can think of all the ways they are great, no matter what they have or what they're dealing with. And so that song is beautiful. Of course, the theme song is, that was written by three people. I mean, we've got Bruce Hart, John Stone, and then Joe Raposo. And Joe Raposo was also the director of music and did so many phenomenal songs. And that one was also, hey, how do you get to Sesame Street? Well, I've got news for you, for everybody wondering how to get to Sesame Street. Of course, it was always in the mind, always in the mind. There's you could have a Sesame Street in 2 seconds in your mind. But there is a physical place now in New York City called Sesame Street on about 63rd and Broadway.
Lucille Burbank is an educational media consultant. She spent a decade working in the research department at Sesame Street. She's author of The Inside Secrets of Sesame Street, which is out with a third edition. It was nice speaking with you. Thank you so much, Lucille. I enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure. I did too. Thank you for having me.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, instead of tossing those flimsy plastic shopping bags in the trash, how about turning them into clothing? Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. It's great to have you with us today. I'm Julie Rose. The plastic bags you use to haul stuff home from the grocery store are useful, but they're also a nightmare when it comes to the environment. You've probably seen a lot of them blowing around your neighborhood, even at parks. What if those bags could be recycled into something useful, like clothing? Plastic clothes sound awfully impractical, but MIT engineers think they've got the right formula to turn those flimsy grocery bags into shoes and hoodies that are waterproof, but also breathable. Top of Mind senior producer Cleon Wall spoke with MIT research scientist Svetlana Boryskana. Let's listen.
What would a hoodie made of a plastic bag look like? I'm assuming it's not several bags that are just stretched out over some person.
No, it wouldn't be that, hopefully.
No, it will look like any other hoodie. It, actually, the material we are making right now, and it the fiber can be shaped to look differently depending on the end application, just like any synthetic fiber. So polyethylene is a synthetic polymer. You can spin it different ways.
Okay, let's go back. You mentioned, I think, what the clothes are going to be made out of, and it's called polyethylene. Is that right? Tell me more about this chemical.
Okay, so this is a material you most likely see every day many times, and the most conventional form you would see it in is a grocery bag, but it also occurs in milk bottles and in a lot of other materials around us. This is, in fact, one of the most produced synthetic plastics in the world, but until now, at least, it was not used widely for textile production. It's used in some industrial textiles, but not really in wearable textiles. So it's actually a very simple plastic. It draws a lot of properties from that simplicity.
How is it that you take a plastic bag and make it into a piece of clothing or even just a piece of cloth?
Right. So in a particular case of a plastic bag, you would chop it off in small pieces, possibly mix it with some colorant if the end product needs to be colored. Then you melt this together in the what is called an industrial melt extruder, which is a machine where you melt plastic and then extrude it in the form of fibers. When they cool down and solidify, you have yarn that can be knitted or woven on a standard industrial equipment into any a format. It could be short, it could be socks, it could be scarf, well, anything that you can think about that's made from traditional yarn can be made from polyethylene yarn. But the trick is to engineer precisely the structure of that yarn, what would be the size of each fiber, what would be the surface of each fiber, and that is controlled by the process. But then the end result is yarn like any other, but with some additional properties that you cannot have in any other material.
Why would something that we see as like a grocery bag, that's at least what I would think I would use it for, why would that make for good clothing material? Because again, I'm seeing it as a grocery bag, you're seeing it as something completely different.
Right. It all depends on the form you spin it in. So you can melt it and it comes out as a grocery bag, or you can melt it and then spin it as a bunch of fibers that can be converted into a fabric.
If it's in the bag form and you made that just like if that was covering you or something like that, it would have some problems of being clothing, but you can actually make it so that it breathes better so that it wicks sweat away?
That is correct. Yeah. So we are turning the material from being water repellent, like in the case of a continuous film or bag, into a material that's transparent to the moisture, that actually very efficiently guides moisture along the material and then helps it to evaporate. Yes.
Is that one of the main reasons why this chemical or this plastic has not been used for clothing in the past?
Yes, we believe so. Because that was one of the most commonly asked questions we were facing when we started working on this material, and we wondered ourselves. So, and I believe this was the major impediment to the use in wearable textiles. Other two considerations that people usually bring up, one is it's impossible to dye color this material the traditional way. And in addition, so if you look at the same problem from a different point of view, you can actually consider it an advantage. And that's what we do, because if dyes don't attach to the material, nothing else does too. So it's a stain repellent property. So it's very easy to keep it clean or to wash it quickly.
Basically, the reason why this is so good is because you've now been able to form it in such a way, you've now been able to form polyethylene in such a way that it wicks away sweat, but it also can't really stain the clothes, or it's at least stain resistant?
Yes, it's highly stain resistant. This property exists in the film form too. as you know, with a plastic bag, it's very easy to wash it and stains don't form on it. But now if the same property is embedded in clothes, it's very useful in terms of their maintenance.
Are there any other benefits?
Well, the benefit, again, to the regular kind of wearer is just higher comfort and the understanding that it's also a lower environmental footprint. That's not usually why people buy clothes, but we hope this type of material can be purchased for the obvious useful properties to the wearer, but also give them satisfaction of purchasing something that's more environmentally friendly.
How is it more environmentally friendly though? Because it's still, to me, I still look at it and I'm thinking it's still plastic. I mean, we see plastic all along the roads. You know, people have discarded their plastic bags everywhere. How is this environmentally friendly?
Well, it actually can provide the pathway to recycling those plastic bags. Right now, they are not recycled well because it's not economically viable to recycle them back into plastic bags. It just doesn't make sense from the economic point of view. But if you can recycle something with almost no value into something with high added value, like textiles and especially high-end textiles, it could make it more interesting economically for somebody, provides an incentive to recycle. And also, if you just look at the process of making this material, it requires less energy, less water than traditional textiles. So it's savings at the production phase. Also, because it's stain resistant and dries very quickly, it requires less maintenance at the use phase. So you don't need to wash it for a long time and you don't need to dry it for a long time. So that's energy and water savings. And because we derive all the properties of the new material from mechanically engineering it without adding any other chemistry to it, without mixing it with other polymers, it can be completely recyclable at the end of the life cycle.
How does this fabric feel? I mean, when you compare it to cotton or polyester or any other types of things that we wear, how does it feel on the skin?
To me, the closest fabric by feeling is silk. So it actually looks quite silky, white and shiny, and it has this cool touch, like the natural silk, and it's even more so. So when you touch it with your fingertips, you can get this immediate cool touch sensation, which is great because that could be useful for the summer type of passive cooling applications. And this is not just a transient sensation that you only get first time when you touch it. Our testing shows that when you put this material on the skin versus other materials, you can continuously reduce the temperature by a couple of degrees, the temperature of the human skin. Now, a degree or two does not sound like a lot, but for the human body, it's actually a very big difference. We can really feel it.
And then finally, it sounds like you would like to eventually see the bags that we see at the grocery store recycled and turned into clothing. How soon do you think this will happen, that we'll be able to either go to a store or go online and buy clothing made out of polyethylene?
Well, we hope pretty soon. I mean, I cannot speak for the recycling industry, but at least in terms of just making products from this material, we think next year is quite feasible. So we actually have a student team trying to spin off a startup company from MIT later this year. And we're also working with big retailers and producers of sports apparel, trying to get the interest and get this material to the market on a larger scale.
That's Svetlana Boryskina, a research scientist at MIT. She spoke with Top of Mind senior producer Cleon Wall. And that's it for our show today. Thanks for tuning in. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Ciara Hewlett and Cleon Wall produced the show with help from Sam Faulkner, Cecilia Foster, Abby Harrelson, Martha Harris, Sydney Jezik, Aubrey Johnson, Haley Kendall, and Olivia Young. You can listen on demand by subscribing to our podcast. Just look for Top of Mind in your favorite podcast app. Or ask your smart speaker to play the Top of Mind podcast. We are online at byuradio.org/topofmind. And we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is topofmind@byu.edu. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.